This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to, sadly, the final edition of Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. But we will be here for about 55 minutes or so, answering your questions of a nostalgic nature about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Our thanks to the Dry and Reinbold team for allowing us to use their garage throughout the month. The track is closed, the concert is over, and we're smelling grilled steaks, or grilling steaks. That's a wonderful smell. Anyway, we do have callers already lined up, and so let's go straight to the phones. And Bill, you're first. Thanks for calling in.
Yes, Donald. This is Bill from Rancho Mirage.
Hello, Bill. I'm sorry that you had such a problem getting in the other night,
or several nights. You have a wonderful show, Donald.
Well, thank you. You're in the pole position. What would you like to hear about?
I want to hear about the drivers from Wichita Falls, Texas.
Okay.
Lloyd Ruby, we all know about Lloyd and his wonderful career. There was another driver there that preceded Lloyd in the 30s and 40s, whose name was George Behringer.
Right.
Can you tell us about his career?
Sure. This is an inside job because Bill is the son of George Behringer. George Behringer was from Wichita Falls, Kansas. His first year at the Speedway was 1932, and he drove in practice. He did not make a qualifying attempt. He was in the Kalen and McPherson special, which was actually entered for a driver named George Kalen, who must have decided to turn it over to George Behringer, who was a dirt track driver from Texas that had come up to the Midwest. In 1933, he was in the Wonder Bread B special. The local Wonder Bread company had two cars, and the second one was called Wonder Bread B to distinguish it from the other car. And he practiced with that one, but didn't get that one either. And it was painted white and had red, yellow, and blue supposed to be balloons that were painted on the side, which was and continues to be the Wonder Bread logo. 1934, he was in the race for the first time with the Boyle special, and Boyle product special, which dropped out late and finished 15th, and Chet Gardner was the relief driver. Then in 1935, he was part of the Ford V8 Miller team. They entered 10 cars. We've talked about this several times. It was a deal made between Preston Tucker, who was the team manager, and Edsel Ford, who was Henry's son, and Harry Miller, who designed the cars, and they put in flathead Ford engines, and then they had stock Ford wheels and a stock steering wheel. They entered 10 cars. Nobody's sure as to whether the 10th car ever arrived, but 9 did, and George Behringer, unfortunately, was not able to qualify with 2 of the cars, but he did drive 4 of them. Only 4 of the 10 entered that made the race. And he drove relief for Johnny Seymour. In 1936, he drove a car for Phil Schaefer that was sponsored by the local Kennedy Tank Company, which is still going. And then he finished 8th. And then in 1937, he practiced with the four-wheel drive special, four-wheel drive company from Clintonville, Wisconsin, I think it was. And that it ended up that, in fact, Floyd Roberts was in that briefly, and others. But anyway, Tony Willman was the driver that qualified it. But everybody, there'd be a lot of jumping around in practice. It wasn't like it is now. You just kept trying the right combination until you had the right one, and the combination would often mean changing drivers. Anyway. He did not qualify, George Behringer, but he did drive relief for Cliff Brashear with the Midwest Red Lion Special to finish 5th. And then in 1938, this was the year that apparently he did not enter because it was his 13th year of racing, and he thought it was bad luck to run. And I got that from Bill. I did not know that. In 1939, he drove for Bill White, what we would now call a dirt car, Bill White Special, and he finished 6th, which was his best finish. Then in 1940, he was in one of the Golf Miller, formerly Golf Miller, which was a Harry Miller car with a, it was rear-engined and had a six-cylinder supercharged engine that was tilted over not completely on its side, but it was tilted over at an angle. And early in practice, George Bailey, his teammate, had an accident. The cars ran on pump gas because of golf, and George Bailey suffered fatal injuries. The cars, the first one actually appeared in 38, and so this was the third year for the cars, and they had pontoon tanks on the side. And Eddie Offutt was the chief mechanic, and he decided that they should withdraw the cars, and then when they came back the next year, they looked different because no longer did they have the pontoon tanks. And so George Barringer became available, and Bill White had a car called the Hollywood Payday Candy Bar Special, and Joey Chitwood had taken his driver's test in it, and for some reason it was decided to take him out and put George Barringer in. The car had been 41, and they changed it to 6 because that was George Barringer's earned number from the championship in 39. And he was still running at the end when the race came to a conclusion in 14th place. Then in 1941, he was in one of the golf cars that were back, redesigned. And of all the things to happen, he qualified, was in the race. And on the morning of the race, there was a fire that actually, his was one of the two cars that was involved. And the car was being filled with the fuel for race day, which was gasoline, in the garage, the old wooden garages, the version before the ones that most people remember. And one of Joel Thorne's cars was having some last-minute welding done. And the thinking is that the fumes from the Barringer car floated through like Pepe Le Pew letting off his aroma, and it floated in through the cracks into the next garage, and got to the flame of the welder, and there was this explosion and fire, which ended up burning down about one third of the south bank garages, because they used to run from east to west. And George Barringer's car was just completely destroyed in the fire. And so he was given 32nd place, but it was out of the race. Anyway, then came the war years, and then in 46, back with one of those cars, which was now in his possession, and it was called the Tucker Torpedo Special. There was nothing Tucker about it, except that Preston Tucker was sponsoring it because of the fact that his new passenger cars were rear-engined, and George Barringer was one of the first ones out in 29th place. And then that, on September the 2nd of 46... he was fatally injured at Atlanta, not the track that's there now, but the one-mile track, Lakewood Park, and there was a blinding dust near the end of the race, and a big crash, and it was a double fatality. George Robson, the 1946 winner, was fatally injured, and George Barringer also was fatally injured. He was buried in Wichita Falls, and Lloyd Ruby, who passed away back in March, is buried probably, I don't know, maybe 30 yards, perhaps. Not very far, just up the hill under a tree. So they're both together. And Bill, we thank you for the call. I know you wanted me to talk about the drivers from Wichita Falls, but I think we got the one that you wanted to hear about. And I do appreciate your support and friendship. And but we are going to take a break here because we've got Paul hanging on, Jerry, John, Rex. We'll get to all of you. You listen to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. We are back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley, and straight to the phones. Paul, thanks for hanging on.
Hey, Donald.
Yes,
another
sir.
Great year. Another great year. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
You make my month of May just filled with joy, and many others. So I really do appreciate it.
Thanks, Paul.
I have a friend who lives in Kenosha who knows a gentleman by the name of Rick Daywalt, and he's related to Jimmy Daywalt. Can you talk a little bit about him?
Sure. Jimmy Daywalt was from Wabash, Indiana, And his career at the Speedway went from 1949 to 63. He didn't make the lineup until 53. But I got to say that when he took his rookie test in a car, and I love this name, Bill and Bud's Motor Sales Special. That's what he took his rookie test in. Didn't make a qualifying attempt. And then in 50, he was in the Itting Special briefly, didn't make it. 51 and 52 in the Merkle Machine Works Special. They were out of Fort Wayne. And the car actually was the car Rex Mays had been on the pole in 48 as the Bosio Fast Special. In 53, he was actually in several cars and then ended up with the Chapman Roots Sumar Special, which was supposed to be driven by Gene Force of Richmond, who had a sprint car accident somewhere. I forget now where that was. And so he couldn't drive. So Jimmy Daywalt got the car, qualified, and he finished sixth. He won the Rookie of the Year. He was the second person to win the Stock and Wetzel Rookie of the Year award. And they had a Jimmy Daywalt celebration. And unfortunately, he went over to Winchester the day after the 500 and got hurt and couldn't go to the victory banquet. And then I think they had to postpone Jimmy Daywalt Day or Jimmy Daywalt Night or whatever it was. But then that ended up becoming a regular thing for the winner. There was a fellow over there named Dick Miller who had Dick's Men's Wear, and he would have the 500 winner went over there for a number of years to go out and pick. $1,000 wardrobe was the prize. Anyway, we're talking about Jimmy Daywalt. So sixth in 53. In 54, he qualified they bought a new Curtis Roadster. He qualified for the middle of the front row. He led eight laps and got tangled up, I think, at lap 112 or 111 with Pat Flaherty, who had just taken over as relief for Jim Rathman. And so that took them out. In 55, he showed up with a Sumar Streamliner, completely enclosed with a canopy. And one by one, they took the streamlining off. Jimmy Daywalt was not, apparently, he was a little unnerved by not being able to see the wheels. His entire racing career had been open cockpit, open wheel cars, and he liked to see the left front go onto the line at the apex, which you couldn't do with the streamliner, so they took the streamlining off, and he actually qualified it in that form with some unpainted body work. By race day, it was painted, and he finished ninth. 56, still with Sumar. He had an accident and got banged up a little bit, had a bit of a concussion. 57, he was in the Helsey Special, which was actually named for Herb and Elsie Johnson. Helsey was not a product. It was made up of their two names. And he spun out and got 28th. 58, he didn't qualify. He was in the Central Excavating Special and the Federal Engineering Detroit Special, but didn't qualify either. In 59, the Federal Engineering Detroit Special qualified in the back, but he was actually the third fastest qualifier in the field, which was a stat that he really enjoyed and was surprised that anybody would know, because he just figured that one would get lost. But he was third in terms of speed rank, and he did complete the full 500 miles in 14th place, sometime about probably 15, 20 minutes after Roger Ward had won the race. 1960. He qualified the Bryant Heating and Cooling Special, but having qualified it in 26th position, when they were out for Carburation Day, some changes had been made, and he said, I don't feel right in this car, and so I'm going to politely withdraw. And so they put Dempsey Wilson in on race day, and Dempsey ran 11 laps and dropped out for 33rd. All right, 61, Jimmy Daywalt, almost there. Another one of my favorite car names, Schultz Fueling Equipment Company Special. Went out very early with brake failure, but got 31st. 62, the Albany, New York Special owned by Tassie Vadis, and he finished 22nd. And then the final shot in 63 was with the Winds Friction Proofing Special owned by Joe Hunt. Made an incomplete attempt and waved off, got out of the car, and it didn't. Chuck Rohde tried to qualify it, and that was the end of Jimmy Daywalt's career. He retired. He was a very good sprint car driver. Was fourth in the AAA Midwest standings in 50. and was third in the CRA championship in 1948, 47 or 48. Little hazy on that one now. Shouldn't have gone there. I think Jimmy Wilburn the champion, and I think George Tishner was second, and Jimmy Daywalt was third. Anyway, there was Jimmy Daywalt, his first wife was named Carmelita Dodd, and she was from Lake Schaefer, for real. Actually, was born and raised there, and she was on local television. She had her own show, I think 15 minutes on Channel 4, and she played the organ and sang. And there was surprise. If you knew Jimmy Daywalt, a very nice guy, very gentle. And it was a surprise to me to learn that he actually did catch the end of World War II and was in Europe doing the same thing that Chuck Stevenson was doing, which is ferrying bombers. And if you ever met Jimmy Daywalt, you'd never thought that he would be a guy that would have ferried bombers at the end of World War II. The other thing, too, was that he was an excellent skater, roller skates and ice skating, and apparently was good enough that he, not only did he win competitions, and I didn't know this until later, apparently he could have pursued a professional career and had to decide between whether he wanted to be a professional ice skater in shows or be a race driver. So he chose race driver. He passed away April of 1966, and even then, I think he was only probably 45 or 46 years old. But very nice guy. Anyway, Paul, thank you very much indeed, and I certainly appreciate your support through this whole season and for the last several seasons. Appreciate your calls. If people didn't call in, we would never call in show. All right, Jerry, you're up next. Is this Jerry from Delphi?
Yes.
Hello, Jerry.
Hi. It's been a great year.
Thanks.
Great year. Really enjoyed it. I'd like to know if you could profile for me Jack McGrath.
All right, I would love to do Jack McGrath. I'll tell you what, we just have a few seconds before we have to take a break here. And so this is going to sound like I'm pitching a break so I can go and look at Wikipedia or get out notes or something. But no, I can do Jack McGrath off the top of my head, and I'll be happy to do that. But we will have to take a break in just a few moments. So just take a few seconds right here, if we don't get to it at the end of the program, to sincerely thank everybody who was kind enough to call in. And for those of you that listened and passed on comments, because we really do enjoy doing the show, and hopefully we can do it again next year. Anyway, we're going to take a break for right now, but we will be back in about 3 or 4 minutes or so, and we'll talk about the career of Jack McGrath when we return. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. We are back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana, and Jerry from Delphi, a very faithful listener, has asked us to talk about Jack McGrath. Jack McGrath came to the Speedway very quickly. He started racing after the war in track roadsters. And I've had several people ask me about track roadsters recently. They basically were hot rods, and a lot of the West Coast drivers, a few Midwest. I don't think they raced them on the East Coast, but big on the West Coast. And many of the great drivers of the 50s and the early 60s came out of that type of racing. But McGrath got here in a hurry. He was at the Speedway in 1948 and driving for Bill Scheffler, Bayard T. Scheffler, also known as T-Bone, who was rather unusual at that time in that he'd gone to UCLA. And at the moment, other than Dwayne Carter, I can't think of another college educated driver. But anyway, Bill Scheffler was one, and he had two cars, and Jack McGrath drove the second one. And he dropped out and finished in 21st place. But the trivia is that his chief mechanic was named Mel Layton. And despite a number of claims by other people, Mel Layton actually was an African-American, and he was not a crew member. He was the chief mechanic in 1948. Anyway, in 1949, McGrath drove the City of Tacoma special owned by Leo Daubree. It was a dirt car, and he qualified for the outside of the front row, which was pretty remarkable because 1-2 were the Novis of Duke Nalon and Rex Mays, and McGrath was on the outside. And I remember Jack Beckley telling me one time, because he said we were the new kids in town, and the officials came and said We hear that you're thinking that you're going to try and lead at the start. And Jack said, are you kidding? Against the two known vice? No, we're going to fall in and run a leisurely pace behind them. Anyway, McGrath dropped out, was 26th. Then, in 50, he started his relationship with Jack Hinkle, and Jack Beckley went with them. So for the next few years, it was the three Jacks, Hinkle, Beckley, and McGrath. Jack McGrath actually spun when the rain started in 1950 at 345 miles, and the race was stopped, and they ended up 14th. In 51, McGrath had his first good finish. He started on the outside of the front row and led at the start, but was soon passed by Lee Wallard. Anyway, he finished third, except that he only drove the first half. He suffered from leg cramps, and his longtime friend Manny Aiello took over and drove the second half to third place. Then 52, outside of the front row again, and this time had some problems along the way, but he did complete the full distance in 11th. And then in 53, he drove a dirt car that actually was out on the track today in the vintage car runs that were after the pit stop contest was complete this afternoon. And he started on the outside of the front row again, third year in a row, and finished fifth. And then in 54, they got a Curtis Roadster, still Jack Hinkle, and McGrath put it on the pole, and he broke the track records. He had the four-lap average was 141 and some change, and the fastest lap was 142 and some change. He led several laps, and he ended up third. He was catching Jimmy Bryan, who was slowing down in the late stage. Vukovich won the race. Bryan was second, and I think McGrath was like about 7 seconds out of catching Bryan for second. In 55, they had this bizarre situation, and we've told the story several times. Short version, there were only two qualifiers on the first day, Jerry Hoyt and Tony Bettenhausen, on a very windy day when nobody wanted to go. On the second day, Jack McGrath broke his own records and had a four-lap average of 142 and some change, with a one lap at 143 and some change. He started on the outside of the front row, and I'd have to count him up, because he started on the outside of the front row in 49, 51, 52, 53, and 55. That's five times. The early stages of the 55 race was a battle between he and Bill Vukovich, back and forth and back and forth, about five or six times. People will tell you there's more than that, but it wasn't. But they were hung together. And dramatically, when Vukovich had his fatal accident, Jack McGrath had just pulled out of the race and was in the pits and was changing his own spark plugs. Haven't seen a driver do that for a while, because he was effectively his own chief mechanic. And there's some really dramatic film footage of the yellow light on, and McGrath actually stops what he's doing and walks out to the middle of the not the pit lane, because they didn't have a pit lane in those days, but he actually, with his back to his race car, he goes a few steps closer to the racetrack proper, and he counts off, or he with one finger, he's doing a mental calculation on the cars that go by, and then he stands with a sort of a what happened kind of a thing with upturned palms. And then, of course, then the reason is that it's his great friend and very friendly rival, Bill Vukovich, has been fatally injured. I'm probably not doing McGrath service here, because he did win several championship races and was runner-up in points in 53. But there's a little anecdote about 55, because I would say that Vukovich, there's no question Vukovich was the man in the early 50s. The closest rival that he had day in, day out at Indianapolis was probably Jack McGrath. In 55, Vukovich was driving for Lindsey Hopkins, and the car was a little bit late in arriving. And one day, McGrath gave Vukovich his car to take out and take a few test laps. And he said he was jittery, and I thought he needed to settle down a bit, so we let him have a few laps. Anyway, Jack McGrath was fatally injured in the final AAA race of the 55, but ever, which was the Phoenix 100-miler. And McGrath, apparently was going to give up championship racing and drive only Indianapolis in 1956. I'll come back with a note on that when we return. But anyway, he was fatally injured in the final race of 55. And we do have to take a break right now, but I'll come back with one footnote on McGrath, and then we will continue on. So, thank you for hanging on, everybody. John, Rex, hang on. If you want to get on the end, and Jack, if you want to try and get on the end, it's 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. Back after this with more of the Talk of Gasoline Alley. We are back with about 15 minutes left on the Talk of Gasoline Alley, and we'll try to get to as many callers as we can. Just a couple of notes on McGrath is that after he was fatally injured, Jack Hinkle, the car owner who was from Wichita, Kansas, an oil man, he sold, I mentioned Herb and Elsie Johnson earlier. It was actually that car was the Hell Special in 56 and 57 was actually the McGrath Hinkle Roadster. Hinkle sold that car to Herb and Elsie Johnson, and he sold the dirt car to Cecil McDonald, and that's the car that was out here today, back in Hinkle livery. And from what I understand, Hinkle gave the money from both cars to Lois McGrath, who was Jack McGrath's widow. The other thing too is there's been quite a bit of interest in the what is known as the Keck Roadster, the Keck Streamliner, or the Vukovich Streamliner. That was built for Vukovich, or actually built. It was never finished. That's the thing. It's finished now, but I think it was finished in 1985 or something. Anyway, after after Vukovich lost his life in 55, Frank Kuhn and Jim Travers, who were Keck's mechanics, were still going to campaign that car if Keck would ever decide whether he was going to run or not, which was an on-again, off-again, on-again, off-again thing. After Vukovich was fatally injured, they were going to do that program in 56 with Jack McGrath. And then after they lost him at Phoenix, then they were going to do it with Troy Ruttman, but it ended up the Streamliner wasn't done. Anyway, back to the phones, and John, you're up next.
Hi, Donald. John,
how are you, sir?
Columbia Station.
Oh, yeah, sure. Thanks for your emails and the excellent questions.
Oh, you're welcome. First of all, if Bill Berenger is still listening, I'd just like to say that his dad may have been gone for 60 years, but he's certainly not forgotten. I was just looking at some photographs of him with Harry Miller looking over that mid-engine, or actually rear-engine car. So, you know, it may have been a long time, but we haven't forgotten him.
Okay, well, I'll tell you that Bill Berenger, if he doesn't have those, we need to get the two of you together. But anyway, go ahead.
Okay. Well, these aren't originals. These are published photos.
Okay.
But I'd certainly be glad to give you the sources. I just wondered if you could do Lou Welch?
A little Lou Welch?
Yes.
Oh, the Novi man. All right. Lou Welch was a friend of Henry Ford. An industrialist, he entered two cars in 35 that were Ford V8 Millers that didn't make it with Herb Ardinger as driver. He had a car that had one of the Fords, they put an Offie in it, and in 37, it was called the Chicago Rawhide Oil Seal Special with Herb Ardinger. Dropped out, finished 22nd, and Jimmy Snyder was the relief driver. He had this, and I have to hurry this one up. He had the sixth place finisher in 38 with Herb Ardinger, Cliff Brazier, and Russ Snowberger, and then third in 39 with Cliff Brazier. And I'll cut to the chase here. In 1941, there's a car called the Beauseal Fire Special. Ralph Hepburn's the driver. It has a V8 engine called the Winfield. Well, actually, that was the first Novi. Lou Welch had his businesses in Novi, Michigan, which until 1958 wasn't even a village. It's now a city, but that's where the Novi Equipment Company was, where he built equipment, standard equipment and non-standard equipment for the Ford Motor Company. Anyway, he's the man that owned the Novis, and very quickly where that came from was that Bud Winfield built a straight eight in 1938 that ran as the Bosio Fast Special with Louis Meyer driving. And on a rainy day, the story is that Lou Welsh went in to talk to Bud Winfield and had discussion about if money were no object, what would you build? And apparently Bud Winfield said, well, I've got this idea for a V8 supercharged, but it would be very expensive to build. And Lou Welsh apparently said, well, let's do it. And so, anyway, that was the car that ran in 41. And then what followed next was the run of the Novice from 46 to 60, although they won in the race every year. And I'll really hurry this one up. Ralph Hepburn, Duke Nalon, Cliff Brazier, Rex Mays, and then later on Paul Russo, Bill Cheeseburg, Dempsey Wilson, although he didn't make it into the race, and on and on and on. Well, Lou Welsh eventually had a reversal of fortune, and it was something over the government wanting to build a dam on property that he owned. And as I understand it, I mean, Lou Welsh was a very proud man, and he got into a dispute with the track on a couple of occasions over prize money, and threatened to withdraw the cars or withhold the entries and so on and so forth. And I could do more on that, but we're sort of kind of running out of time here. But anyway, he went to he fought the government and lost, and it kind of was his undoing. And so in March of 1961. A very grateful Granatelli was able to buy the Novi team for just a song. But anyway, so that's kind of a quick one on Lou Welsh. We're going to try and get to Rex, Jack, and Larry when we come back. We'll just have a few minutes to do that, but we'll try to get to everybody. So let's take a break right now, and we'll be back and wind up the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Back with a few minutes left on the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. For those of you who may be listening on 1070 The Fan, we did not have a chance to talk to you earlier because of another program, but a reminder that we will be following the race. When Network goes off the air on race day, which we're estimating to be 5 o'clock, we will be doing a drive-home show and anticipate going until 8. So if we didn't get to all of you tonight, maybe you can call us after the race. All right, Rex, you're up next.
Hello, Donald?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I know you're pressed for time. I'll make it quick.
Okay.
Now, you were saying a couple weeks ago that Colin Chapman made disparaging remarks when he came to the track.
Yeah.
About the Nova, about the Roadsters,
yeah.
Engineering being maybe fundamental and obsolete. Mm-hmm. Could that be, and when I'm done asking a question, let me make a fast comment on this.
Okay.
Could it be because of the end result of the 1963 race that might have left him a little bitter that way? And let me just say that any mechanic on Gasoline Alley will be the first to tell you that even though Colin Chapman was a tremendous, tremendous genius, on his best day, he wasn't worthy to carry out Harry Miller's shop rag. That meaning the Miller Brain Trust, Miller, Goosen, and Offenhauser.
Okay, I don't think that had anything to do with 63. I think that Colin Chapman was a brilliant man, always looking ahead, and he was looking for space age technology, and that's not exactly what we were doing at the Speedway, but or what they were doing at the Speedway. I wasn't around yet, but we just loved them Roadsters. But I think he called them junk or something like that. But that's okay. That's all right.
Well, he was sadly mistaken.
I agree.
He was sadly mistaken, and the first turbocharged car was at Speedway, and I'm sure in the interest of time, I could go on and on, but a lot of tremendous technical innovation. I don't know where he was coming from. That was probably a part of his personality problem. He wasn't the most stable person personality-wise, even though he was a genius, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah, I heard several stories about him from people that actually worked at Lotus in the passenger car end of it, but we don't have time to go into such a heavy discussion right now. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right,
okay,
Rex.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, Rex, thank you for calling, and let's go to Jack. Jack, you're up next.
Hi, Donald.
Yes, sir.
Jack, and real quick, my very first track experience was when Bobby Marshman and Parnell Jones were co-rookies.
Oh, 61, uh-huh.
61, yeah. And now, the turbine, was that the first year for the turbine?
There was a turbine entered in 61, but the chassis arrived, but the engine didn't. It was going to be the John Zink track burner with Troy Ruttman as driver.
Okay.
But the first...
I was there, and I was thinking there was a turbine that was out on the track, and Made almost the complete race, but due to a 60-cent item, it failed.
No, that was 1967. Bobby Marshman was no longer around when that happened, so I think you've got several things running together. Parnelli Jones was the driver of the turbine.
Okay.
All right, thanks, Jack. And I think we can get to Larry. Miraculously, we're going to be able to get to everybody. So, Larry, you've got it. What's up?
I'd like to hear a little bit about my favorite PA announcer at the track, John Totten, please.
Oh, John Totten. I went to Purdue and worked for, I think, WFBM radio and television back in the days when they could go back and forth. And I remember that whenever he would do weekend sports, he would always lead with motor racing. And I don't know if he got into trouble for that, but I remember one night that he did the sports cast on Sunday evening. And I think he did, like, the USAC championship race, and then he did a NASCAR race, and then sprints and midgets. And I think, boy, he's going to get into trouble for that. But anyway, for a number of years, he would sit up top, and he would do Tom Carnegie would be trackside and get the timing and scoring information. There was a fellow named Chuck Bailey who also did what John did, which was to say, halfway around on this one, and up close to the wall, and down a little higher on this lap, and then Ben Carnegie would come in with, and here's the time and speed report. Anyway, that was John Totten for many years. And also, he was very discreet. And the greatest example of that was when Gordon Smiley had a horrendous accident at the north end just prior to taking the green flag. He was on the warm-up laps and hit the wall big time, and that's an understatement, at the north end, and coming out of turn three, and all John Totten said, and we have a problem at the north end. And that's about as understated as it could possibly be. But he did the job by alerting everybody to the fact that something had happened, but he did not. But, I mean, he was as cool, calm, and collected as could possibly be. Anyway, I'm very grateful that we managed to get everybody in tonight. And so we do have a few moments that we can kind of wind down, take our breath, and just thank sincerely everybody. I'd like to thank the Dry and Reinbold Racing Team for allowing us to be in their garage. I'd like to thank the Indianapolis Motor Speedway for putting on the event and for Tony George and his family for saving the place and keeping it going. And most especially to all of the people who just have the interest in the history of the place, because we love to tell these stories. I mean, this is we just love doing this, and it's so gratifying that so many people care. Matt Taylor, you've been fantastic all month. That's the fellow that's answered the phones when you called in. And whenever I was down at the studio, he was the on-site producer. Out here, the on-site producer, we couldn't do it without him, is Scott Johnson. Scott, thanks again for another great season. We'll see you after the race. You've been listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. Good night, everybody. We'll